something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Thanks for turning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up in this program, going to Tehran, why the United States must come to terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Flynn and Hillary Mann Leverett argue that the U.S. needs to change its policies towards the Iranian government, and the Iranian government is a rational actor, and it will play a leading role in the Middle East for many decades to come.
It is an honor this morning to introduce Flynn Leverett, who served at the National Security Council, the State Department, and the CIA. But he's currently a professor at Penn State out of Carlisle. Also with him is Hillary Mann Leverett, and she served at the National Security Council and the State Department. She negotiated the U.S. government with the U.S. government with Iranian officials. She's now a senior professor lecturer at American University in Washington. Their writing has appeared in the New York Times, Politico, Foreign Policy, and Washington Monthly, among others. They came to us last night from Virginia. Mm-hmm. They took the late night train and stayed here. And what I'd like to do is just turn it over to you for your thoughts and comments to start off.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to start off for us today. And first, let me begin by thanking you very much for hosting us. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's a real honor and pleasure. We look forward to a very interesting discussion today. I'm going to start with two provocative themes from our new book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. The first of these themes, and these two really get at the heart of our book, the first of these themes is that the United States is today and has been for the past few years a power in relative decline in the Middle East. And the second core theme is that the biggest beneficiary of America's ongoing decline in the Middle East is the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you're not sure you agree with these propositions, I want to ask you to compare the relative positions of the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran in the Middle East today, years ago. On the eve of 9/11, every single government in the Middle East was either pro-American, like the governments in Egypt and Turkey, in negotiations effectively to become pro-American, like the governments in Syria and Libya, or anti-Iranian, like the Taliban government in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq. Every single government in the Middle East was either pro-American, in negotiations to become pro-American, or anti-Iranian. A pretty good position for the United States in the Middle East. But because of elections, today, governments across the Middle East, in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Lebanon, Palestine, Turkey, Iraq, they are all no longer reflexively pro-American or anti-Iranian. They are all pursuing at least independent foreign policies, which are by definition much less enthusiastic about strategic cooperation with the United States and much more open to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Simply put, today, relatively speaking, the United States is in a profoundly weaker position in the Middle East, and the Islamic Republic of Iran is in a significantly stronger position. This has essentially happened because there has been a dramatic shift in the Middle East's balance of power. In our book, Going to Tehran, we describe how part of why this shift has and is occurring is because of mistakes in American policies in the Middle East. But we also describe in our book that part of what is going on is something vastly underappreciated in the West, which are the successes of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which are also driving this shift in the regional balance of power. We argue in our book that these two are inextricably linked, the American policy mistakes and the successes that the Islamic Republic is driving, that they are linked, and that it is in fact America's dysfunctional policy toward the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is at the heart of our decline in the Middle East. We also argue that it will take strategic realignment by the United States with the Islamic Republic of Iran to enable America's strategic recovery in the Middle East. We unpack these arguments first by examining the bases for U.S. dominance in the Middle East, something increasingly driven since the end of the Cold War by America's unique capability to project enormous amounts of conventional military force into the Middle East. No one else, not even China, can project this kind of military force into the Middle East today or for years to come. This muscle has given the United States extraordinary economic and political influence in the Middle East, and in fact has reinforced our military and economic dominance in other key parts of the world. But our failures in Afghanistan and Iraq in particular have underscored for the world, and especially for Middle Eastern publics, the limits of what American military might can accomplish. We argue in our book that these failures in U.S. Middle East policy were not just idiosyncratic, ideologically generated products of the George W. Bush administration. As we describe in our book, these stem from a much deeper source that cuts across both Democratic and Republican administrations. It's something we describe as the United States essentially giving in to a post-Cold War temptation to act as an imperial power in the Middle East. And it is this imperial turn in America's Middle East policies, pursued with very little regard for realities on the ground in the Middle East, that has proven not just quixotic, but deeply damaging to American interests. As a candidate back in 2008, now President Obama then seemed to really understand this. He talked about it courageously during the campaign. He pledged, in fact, to not just withdraw American troops from Iraq, but to change what he called the American mindset that had gotten us into the strategic mistake of invading Iraq in the first place. He pledged to really change America's Middle East policies. But instead, the Obama administration has pursued the same sorts of policies as its predecessors, the same policies that did such damage to America's strategic position. As a result, for example, the Obama administration today is not just presiding over a stalled Middle East peace process, it is presiding over the very demise of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And while the Obama administration's military intervention in Libya was able to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, it is now incubating in Libya a significant threat to American security interests. And as we detail in our book, Going to Tehran, the Obama administration has gone beyond the Bush administration in threatening the Islamic Republic to doing something we argue is even more dangerous, to actually discrediting engagement as a strategy for dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. They've done so by saying that they've tried to reach out to the Islamic Republic of Iran and failed, and therefore engagement is perhaps a fool's errand. The results of these policies are that on President Obama's watch, the Middle East's balance of power has shifted even further away from the United States and its allies than it was at the end of the George W. Bush administration. This brings me to another critically important part of our book, which is how the Islamic Republic of Iran has become the biggest beneficiary of American mistakes and our ongoing decline in the Middle East. In our book, we lay out how by pursuing a foreign policy and building a domestic political order that actually attracts Middle Eastern publics, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to take advantage of American mistakes to improve its own position dramatically. The key to the Islamic Republic's successes has been that beyond the shift in the Middle East regional distribution of power, who has power in the Middle East, as I detailed earlier, something even more important is happening, and that is that the Middle East balance of power itself is changing. It is now becoming increasingly less defined by hard military capabilities, where the United States has the clear advantage, and Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is relatively deficient, and more defined in terms of a balance of influence, where the Islamic Republic of Iran has real, unique advantages. As we explain in our book, the Islamic Republic is both encouraging and taking advantage of this very important transformation in the Middle East. One of the most remarkable things about this shift in the Middle East balance of power over the last decade, away from the United States and our allies and toward the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies, is that this shift has had virtually nothing to do with Iran's use of military force or economic coercion.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Gun nuts boasting they can open fire, pumping rounds of red-hot lead, off for sport with their rifles they go, shooting bunnies in the head. Yeah, everybody knows there's Uzis in the Bill of Rights. We machine gun owners have our grounds. We show no fear hunting squirrel or deer. We hose them with 10,000 rounds. You've seen our ads, and they are true. They say that guns don't shoot nobody, gun nuts do. We think a gun's a sign of strength. There's lots of men comparing pistols and their length. And so we're offering this good advice: oppose the NRA and you're through. You understand? Try that and we'll show many times, many ways, we mean business, and we got the big guns, yeah, we do. Ho, 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 take that, Rudolph.
The Islamic Republic hasn't invaded anybody or sanctioned anybody. It's all about the Islamic Republic's soft power. In our book, we set the Islamic Republic's cultivation and reliance on soft power in a strategic context. A critical set of sources that we drew on for our book were unique and unparalleled opportunities we have had to sit and listen to Iranian diplomats and national security officials explain how the world looks strategically from their perspective, from their point of view. This is something almost never done in American analysis of Iran today. And from our experience, our research, our interviews, we detail how from Tehran, looking at the world from Tehran, one sees 15 neighboring states, 15, nearly all of whom have been hostile to the very idea of an Islamic Republic. And not just hostile, but Iran's neighbor to its east, Afghanistan under the Taliban, killed Iranian diplomats in their consulate in Mazar Sharif. The Islamic Republic's neighbor to its west, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, with help from the Islamic Republic's other Arab neighbors, invaded Iran, killing 300,000 of its citizens. And today, many of those same Arab countries that helped Iraq invade and fight the Islamic Republic today host thousands of U.S. troops and billions of dollars worth of the most deadly U.S. weapon systems, all poised and threatening to attack the Islamic Republic, to disarm it of weapons of mass destruction it does not have. To deal with these significant security challenges, the Islamic Republic of Iran has built a strong defensive military capability. But it has virtually no capability to project that military power offensively beyond its borders. So what it has done, and its real success in its national security strategy, has been to develop a soft power strategy. A strategy that galvanizes regional publics, galvanizes these publics' most intensely felt grievances, including their grievances against the United States and Israel, and most importantly, their grievances against their own unrepresentative pro-Western governments and regimes. And then what the Islamic Republic has done is it has aligned itself with those publics, with public opinion itself in the Middle East, to constrain hostile governments from attacking it. Just think about how Bahrain's already angry, largely Shia population would react if we used our Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain to attack the Islamic Republic today. U.S. military planners could hope that Bahrain's population would be passive, as I think they assumed maybe even 5 years ago. But today, that clearly seems reckless. For all the ridiculing many American policy elites do of the Islamic Republic, the Islamic Republic's appeal to regional publics actually works. It works to constrain the United States and hostile, unrepresentative, pro-Western governments neighboring Iran. Iran has also worked to reinforce these aspects of its soft power strategy over a number of years by picking what we would call winners. For example, Hamas, Hezbollah, Shia groups in Iraq, even the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, as its political allies in key regional arenas across the Middle East. And this years-long bet by the Islamic Republic of Iran on these groups has paid off, because now their regional allies have become the most influential players in their respective arenas today. The result is that today it is the Islamic Republic of Iran and its ideas of participatory Islamist governance and an independent foreign policy that has real influence, real power in countries across the Middle East from Egypt to Bahrain that were once clearly in America's camp. In strategic terms, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been and is using, through its narrative, not its drones, not its tanks, through its narrative, they are using the political awakening of Middle Eastern publics to alter the very nature of power politics in the Middle East. As we describe in our book, Going to Tehran, this has been an effective foreign policy and national security strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran, one that is vastly and repeatedly underappreciated in the United States. And at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Flint to continue our discussion.
To pick up on Hillary's point about this soft power strategy being a real strategy for resetting a regional balance of power that Iranian policymakers have long seen as tilted against the Islamic Republic, I think it's important to note, especially for Americans to understand, that it's only an Islamic Republic of Iran which can accrue these kinds of soft power gains. The Shah couldn't have done it. A pro-Western secular republic of Iran couldn't do it. Only the Islamic Republic of Iran can do it. But as we discuss in our book, instead of recognizing and pondering this, American political policy media elites persist in depicting the Islamic Republic as an illegitimate system so despised by its own population that it is in imminent danger of overthrow. American elites have been doing this literally for more than 30 years, virtually since the Islamic Republic's founding out of the Iranian Revolution. And for more than 30 years, the Islamic Republic has consistently defied their relentless predictions of its collapse or defeat. The Islamic Republic has survived because its basic model, the integration of participatory politics and elections with principles and institutions of Islamic governance and a strong commitment to foreign policy independence, this model is, in actual fact, what a majority of Iranians living inside their country want. They don't want a political order grounded in Western-style secular liberalism. They want an indigenously generated political order that reflects their cultural and religious values. As the reformist President Mohammad Khatami said shortly before leaving office, they want, these were his words, freedom, independence, and progress within the context of both religiosity and national identity. And that's what the Islamic Republic, with all its flaws, offers Iranians the chance to pursue. This was the vision of Imam Khomeini, embodied in the Islamic Republic's constitution. And even those Iranians who want the Islamic Republic to evolve in significant ways, at the end of the day, even most of those Iranians still wanted to be the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the course of our visits to Tehran, a number of the politicians, policymakers, scholars that we talked to have pointed out to us that the Islamic Republic doesn't call itself an Islamic state, like, say, Saudi Arabia does. For that implies a kind of perfection that Iranians deeply invested in the system know they have not attained. In Iran, the Islamic Republic is, by definition, something that is very much a work in progress. And the Islamic Republic has made progress in a number of impressive ways. Contrary to deeply rooted but ill-informed Western stereotypes, the Islamic Republic has achieved far more progressive outcomes in alleviating poverty, delivering health care, providing educational access, and yes, expanding opportunities for women than the Shah's regime ever did. Hillary and I are happy to go into this more in the Q&A if you like, but let me give you just a couple of examples right now of what I'm talking about. The Islamic Republic has developed a healthcare system that has greatly increased life expectancy and greatly reduced infant and child mortality in Iran. The provision of healthcare to rural areas has been particularly impressive since the revolution. The Islamic Republic has basically equalized health outcomes in urban and rural settings in a manner which is really quite extraordinary in an international context. Get this. There are now Iranian doctors and public health specialists working with state universities and NGOs in the state of Mississippi to into medically underserved parts of the Mississippi Delta. The Islamic Republic has also greatly expanded educational opportunities, vastly increasing literacy rates in Iran, and according to the World Bank, basically eliminating gender disparities in educational access. One facet of women's progress in Iran that remains almost completely unappreciated in the West is the way that access to higher education is altering the status of Iranian women. While the Islamic Republic places restrictions on women, say in matters of dress, for example, that Westerners would consider unacceptable in their own societies, the majority of university students in Iran are now female. The majority of students in the best universities in Iran are now female. The majority of medical students in Iran are now female. And women's presence is increasingly felt across an array of academic and professional disciplines.
Everything was fine in Gina before they came along. Michigan and Harlem and all them brown towns. Rising tide lifts all boats. Dave and Duke got all our votes. Everything is fine in Gina. There ain't a single thing that a white can do that a black can't do in Gina too, except live in a nice house on a nice street. Accumulated wealth over generations, you can't call that a racist nation. Everything's fine in Gina. We don't have a race problem here. It's not about color, it's about crime and fear. Black kids want to sit on a white tree. Sounds to me like a crime spree. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I can end your life with a stroke of a pen. Everything is fine, Gina. Don't tell me you don't do the same, cause your New York Bell had a different name. Michael's in jail, Sean's 6 feet under. So it goes, that's the situation. You can't call that a racist nation. Everything is fine in Gina. Used to have an underground railroad, now we railroad them here at home. Just because it's a prettified plantation. You can't call that a racist nation. Everything is fine. You can't call that a racist nation. Everything is fine.
And now for something completely different.